Americans for the Arts.
Well, the following program is dedicated to Evelyn Louise Mott, teacher, humanitarian, information specialist, mom of five, Evelyn Louise Schmidt Sinaki Mott. Wise, earnest, and kind, she worked for democracy, social justice, and the good of humanity throughout her life. Her family is listening in from across the country, the Sinakis, the Millers, the Schmidts, and the Williams. Part of today's program is brought to you in memorial for Evelyn Mott, longtime humanitarian and soldier for human dignity. She listened to and greatly appreciated WMNF Independent News and Public Affairs, including Midpoint Monday with Sean Cunnan. Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. Coming up today, we're going to talk with a local man who just got back from Iran, given the heightened tensions between Iran and the U.S. We're going to talk about what's going on inside the nation of Iran in just a moment. Later, we'll take your phone calls. First, one listener comment about yesterday's program. Yesterday, for part of the program, we discussed saving Florida's environment. Here's what one listener had to say.
Yes, there's always a lot of talk about the raw sewage and other pollutants dumped into the bay, gulf, and aquifers by our municipalities. And most often, these mishaps are described as being caused by heavy rains and by aging infrastructure. But as with our road problems and many of our other problems, the real cause of all of it is that too many people have been allowed to move into Florida. Densification has been emphasized. There's just too many people for the system. And there's really no way you could build out the system to accommodate the existing population load and the increased population load that keeps on coming. So until we actually have an honest discussion about carrying capacity, both ecological and infrastructural, we'll continue to see sewage dumped into our public commons.
Well, there's a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. Well, you're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. I'm Rob Loride. Coming up, we're going to speak with a former resident of Sarasota. He grew up in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, and for a time, he was a political candidate. In 2016, he was running for the Charter Review Commission in Sarasota. His name is Robert Neff. And he just returned from a two-week visit to Iran. He's now a nursing student in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University. With all the tension between the U.S. and Iran in the past few years, especially with the U.S. backing out of the Iranian nuclear deal, we figured we'd get an insider's view of what's going on in Iran with Robert Neff next here on WMNF. Rob Neff, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Rob, you traveled to Iran recently. When did you go, and why did you go there?
So, this initial trip started off, I'm currently a full-time graduate student at a nursing school up in Baltimore, and I kind of saw the direction that we're going as far as U.S. foreign policy is concerned when, you know, John Bolton was in office, and, you know, I grew up in Saudi Arabia. I'm an American citizen. I've traveled pretty much through most of the region of the Middle East. Iran was one location that I had never been. And so I originally intended to travel to Iran to kind of meet with my fellow nursing students and medical students there and kind of just create an open dialogue between both of us. And I guess you could say you win some proverbial hearts and minds. That whole process took about 6 months. Unfortunately, at the very last minute, the day of, they kind of pulled my permission to meet with some of the medical and nursing students. So I was not able to do that. That being said, as an American or a Brit, as a Canadian that's traveling into Iran, you cannot travel independently. So you have to have a more or less a minder with you at all times. So one of my contacts at one of the hospitals in Iran had set me up with an officially sanctioned government minder. And there was an additional full tour itinerary that I had planned in addition to going to the medical school. So kind of decided the rest of the trip went well with the exception of that bit. But yeah, the whole process took about 6 months, and it really just started off initially as being a way to just kind of have the start a dialogue and maybe come back, tell the story, and you know, the way that I was perceived in Iran and what the Iranian people think of Americans is significantly different than what we are told here in the United States.
So the process of getting in took 6 months. The trip itself, though, I believe I read, took 2 weeks, right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. It took about 2 weeks. And I returned about, 2 weeks ago. Yeah, I started off in the capital city of Tehran, which is a sprawling metropolis up in the northern part of the country of about 13 million people. Then I flew down into the southern province, into Shiraz. And then myself and my minder, we basically drove 1,000 kilometers back up to Tehran, stopping in off in Yazd, Arbakhul, and Isfahan as well. And, you know, I'll say that Iran is a tremendously diverse country. You have Kurds, you have Persians, you have Arabs, you know, Sunni, Shiites, Jews, Christians, Baluchis. It's not the monolithic perspective that we're sometimes, you know, sold here in the U.S. And depending on where you go in the country, it's going to be significantly culturally different than other parts of the country.
So you traveled by yourself. You were not a part of a tour group. And I assume you paid for the trip by yourself?
Well, I traveled with my, like I said, as an American, you can't travel alone. So I did travel with my minder, my guide, more or less. And we drove in his personal car from after we flew down to Shiraz. We drove up north. We drove in his personal car all the way back to Tehran. But yeah, no, this is something that, you know, I paid for by myself. You know, there are occasionally Americans that do travel to Iran. The general demographic of those people that go, I would say, are usually in their 70s or 80s, very well traveled. They're basically retirees, and they're traveling there because this is kind of one of the few countries that travelers have not, you know, been granted access to, and it's the one place that they haven't been to. And just what I think is unique is just at this particular time, right before I was going, it was about, you know, Trump was about 15 minutes away from launching an airstrike into, obviously, as we all know, in Iran, and he pulled the plug at the last minute. So it was just that given at this certain time, there was just an increased level of tension, more so than we've seen probably between our two countries in recent years.
Well, we're talking with Rob Neff, who's a nursing student at Johns Hopkins School of Nursing, but he has lived in Sarasota, and he was a Green Party candidate in Sarasota in an election in 2016. And this is WMNF in Tampa. We're talking about his trip, his recent trip to Iran. So you said you grew up in Saudi Arabia, that you lived in Saudi Arabia for a while. I wonder if you could compare Iran and Saudi Arabia in terms of free speech and in terms of the way women are treated in both countries.
Yeah, so without a doubt, Iran is a significantly much more secular country than the kingdom is, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. You know, I grew up in Saudi Arabia at a time women were still not permitted to drive. That law only changed, it's been a little over a year now. One of the biggest observations, and I'm saying this as traveling throughout the Middle East, is, you know, in Saudi Arabia, when you have a prayer call, you know, you have prayer call 5 times a day, the entire country more or less shut down, shops closed, you know, people go home, people go to the mosque to pray. In Iran, there is a noticeable lack of that prayer call. When you go to smaller cities like Arbakhul, you can hear it, and parts of Isfahan, but you don't hear the prayer call constantly like you do in Saudi Arabia, and you're not seeing shops close up. As far as women are concerned, the traditional abaya of women in Saudi Arabia is a lot more, I guess you would say, restrictive. But I mean, they're wearing a full face veil. You know, sometimes it's their eyes are showing, sometimes their eyes might not be showing. When you're in Iran, though, there's significantly more freedom of expression for women, especially in the capital city of Tehran. You're not seeing a traditional abaya like what you would see in Saudi Arabia. You're seeing just more of a veil just covering the head. That's basically the only restriction that they have. If you go to some of the smaller parts, you may see people that are women that are more conservatively dressed, but they do seem to have a little bit more personal choice, and depending on their family and the communities that they're coming from as to how much they want to cover. But really the only major restriction that is universal there for women as far as covering is that they do have that veil on them.
What about criticizing the government? When you lived in Saudi Arabia, was it okay to criticize the government? And in your 2 weeks in Iran, what was your sense about whether or not people could criticize their government?
So criticism in Saudi Arabia is obviously a big no-no. That's one of the big issues that they have. Nobody's really critical of the government. That being said, if we look back at the start of the Arab Spring, when it was coming across Arab Africa and then into the Levant, there were massive popular uprisings, and, you know, we all kind of know some of the conflicts that happened. But when the Arab Spring came to not just Saudi Arabia, but toward the Gulf region in general, it more or less fizzled out. And I think a big reason for that was because, you know, a lot of Saudis and a lot of people that are living in the Gulf that are Gulf nationals, they're looking around at the quality of their life. And that's to people that are living in Syria and Lebanon and Egypt, and they're saying, you know, we have pretty good jobs here. We have AC, you know, education, healthcare. We have aspects. So, you know, we may not have some of the same political rights that they have in the West, but we definitely have a high level of quality when we compare our quality of life to our neighbors. So you can't speak out against the king, obviously, but when the Arab Spring did come specifically in the eastern province where I live, there were just minor uprisings that were mostly Shia-based, because that is, in Saudi Arabia, that is the minority population that is occurring. But, you know, political oppression is definitely an issue in both countries. Is particularly in Iran, when I was there, like I said, I did have a minder. So as this trip progressed, you know, we kind of built a relationship with each other, and I kind of got more of my own independence going on as far as what I could do, what I could see, who I could talk to. And it was an interesting conversation that I had with average Iranians, ranging from high school kids all the way to, you know, shopkeepers. There were people that were both pro and anti-Trump. And you had people that respected Trump because, as one shopkeeper in Isfahan told me, that Iran, you know, Trump said that he wasn't going to deal with Iran, and he more or less hasn't dealt with Iran. So there was a level of respect that he had for them. There are people that were anti-Trump, and that would generally break down into two categories. The larger of those two would be basically people that want to travel, study, and move to the United States, and they dislike Trump simply not because of his economic policies, but basically because of the travel ban issue, and they want to come to the United States, and they're not capable of doing that. The other group of anti-Trump are kind of, you know, the old men in the country that they're kind of towing the party line, and they know they've been there since the revolution. They grew up under the revolution, and they kind of, like I said, go with the party line. So they are definitely anti-Trump in that aspect. And then there are other people that just see Trump as basically a reflection of America, and they love all things American. So by default, they love Trump as well. I think it's important to note that I think the statistics is between 60% and 70% of the population is under the age of 30, which means that the majority of the population, the overwhelming majority of the population, has grown up basically post-revolution. And a big issue with why I think they're so pro-American, I mean, I had people that they learned English, and this is not unique to Iran. This is a global phenomenon. They watching U.S. media, U.S. TV, U.S. movies, rap music, this sort of stuff, and so they learn their English from. But since you have this younger generation, and we haven't really, our two countries have not really come to, we've been basically at a proxy war with each other for 30, 40 years, and there's been a lot of push and pull on both sides, but we haven't come really face-to-face with each other. And with that being said, I think there's still peace that can be salvaged, because we haven't had that direct conflict. And that's why I think there's still such an overwhelming amount of pro-Americanism by the Iranian people towards the United States.
Well, our guest is Robert Neff. He just returned from a trip to Iran. For a time, he lived in Sarasota. He's also lived in Saudi Arabia. But right now, he's a nursing student at Johns Hopkins School of Nursing in Baltimore. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So this idea that all Iranians are chanting death to America or hate America, that would be the wrong view to have of Iran.
Absolutely. So, you know, I never saw any of these chants going on. I never witnessed any of those. I did tour the former U.S. Embassy, and some of your listeners may be familiar with some of the images that are on there. You know, there's some kind of infamous paintings and stuff that's out there. But when I went into the embassy, you know, they did have an anti-Trump Bolton and Pompeo sign up there. But there's a very clear distinction between the actions of the U.S. government and the American people. They don't necessarily like the policies that have negatively affected their country, and sanctions is a big part of that. There are people there that are facing critical illness, and the medication that they need, you know, chemotherapy, for example, is extremely expensive. And if they were to purchase that, then they'd basically go into bankrupt their family. And so they choose not to do that. So these are very real policies that we've enacted that are basically harming innocent civilians at the end of the day. But yeah, I would definitely say that sentiment is not one that I noted at all. I've been to over 70 countries and territories. Iran is probably one of the friendliest countries. In a lot of cases, especially when I was in some of the smaller communities, it was the very first time that some of these people had ever met Americans. Sometimes it had been 12, 15 years. And as soon as they find out that you're American, you're a rock star all of a sudden. So the perception that they're out there and they're this death to America stuff, you know, there is a certain element and there's a certain portion of the government that obviously wants to maintain its strength and its position, and it sees certain actions by the U.S. government as oppressive. You know, that being said, Iran is more or less surrounded geographically by the U.S. to certain varying degrees, whether it's, you know, the Saudis across the ocean or, you know, U.S. troop presence in Iraq and Afghanistan. This all exists, so there is that level of tension that is there, and I think a lot of this anti-Americanism is used more as a way to kind of mobilize people, but I don't think that's the true sentiment of the heart of the average Iranian. And that being said, a lot of the murals that you do see that may be anti-American, when you look at our own country and you realize that we have a multi-billion-dollar media production, you know, that if we want to go to war, we can mobilize the American population. So it's kind of hard to compare a guy with a can of spray paint that may be, you know, spray painting the Statue of Liberty looking like the Great Satan when you have a full-on media blitz here in the United States. But no, the Iranian people are some of the nicest people that I've met. And that would be the number one message that I would send to your American listeners, my fellow Americans, is that no, that sentiment it does not exist.
Rob, I want to get back to a question I asked earlier, though, and that is, you said the Saudis are afraid to criticize their own government. You can't criticize the king of Saudi Arabia. And you talked about some people were pro and anti-Trump in Iran, but in Iran, can people criticize their own government without fear?
You know, a lot of that depends on where exactly you are in the countries. So some of the more conservative areas, that's a no-no. I did have one interesting conversation with an individual that was basically started going off and saying that, you know, Iran, she was a young lady, she's saying it's not a good government. You know, it's very hard on the people. And I was sitting there with her and her grandfather. Her grandfather didn't speak any English. My guide kind of came up and he heard the direction that it was coming from. And he kind of, under that condition, he kind of pulled me away from that situation. So I would definitely say that the freedom of speech there isn't allowed, definitely not to any extent that we're used to here in the United States. I had another interaction with a Kurdish woman. You know, Kurds in Iran are part of Iranian society, but they are a significant minority. But she was telling me that Kurds and the Baha'i people as well, which are also Iranians, are significantly discriminated against under Iranian society. They're not allowed access to a lot of government services that most Iranians have access to. For example, they're not allowed to go to school, so this puts them at a tremendous educational and economic disadvantage for the rest of their life. So that discrimination is occurring towards minorities. And I'll add on to that as well, that if you look at like the demographics of Iran, about 70% of the country is of Persian descent. That's the largest Shia Persian. That's the largest basically demographic. But every place that I went where I was under kind of the official government program there, I was told that the combined minority demographic is less than 1%. So effectively, the government's position is that Shiite Persians represent 99% of the population. Which if you look at any kind of global fact book, that's not really the reality. So that being said, those people that are sitting outside in the periphery that are in the minority are definitely under more scrutiny and have less ability to kind of speak up. Though when the Arab Spring was occurring, they had the Green Revolution in Iran, also known as the Twitter Revolution. So there was mass kind of demonstrations that did occur in Tehran and other parts of the country. So, like I said, it's a lot of give and take, push and pull, constantly what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. Alcohol, for example, is one of the big issues. Definitely not allowed, but that being said, my first night in Iran, I landed and there was a young couple that was clearly intoxicated. They were dancing to loud music outside of the car, just having a jolly good old time. The police more or less know that alcohol consumption is going on, but it's one of those things that is becoming much, much more liberal in the fact that they're not looking to arrest people as they used to. Internet access was another big issue. So officially, things, all social media accounts, with the exception of Instagram, are banned. Everything is kind of behind a massive firewall, which is, you know, the same in Saudi Arabia, the same as China. That being said, there are a lot of people that still maintain accounts through VPN networks, which are secure kind of networks, which allow access to kind of circumnavigate this firewall. So I think that allows people to kind of connect to the outside world. It allows people to have connections. I don't think when I was talking to people about the VPN access, they said, how serious is this? Is an issue if you're online there? And they said, you know, you can look at basically anything on the internet as long as it's not political. If you're looking at something political, then they're going to come to your house and, you know, then there's going to be problems like that. But general sort of stuff, not an issue.
Well, our guest is Robert Neff, and you're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. Robert has just returned from a two-week trip to Iran. So you mentioned earlier that you visited mosques and synagogues, churches, and ancient temples. So I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear that there are churches and synagogues in Iran.
Yeah, so I think part of that is a cultural issue. Actually, not just Shiites, but just under Islamic law, traditionally speaking, Christians and Jews have been historically throughout the Middle East allowed to kind of coexist. It generally had to pay like a higher tax or something, historically speaking, depending upon where they live. For example, I went to the Van Cathedral, which is the largest church in Iran, a beautiful church built in 17th century. By Armenian Christians that had immigrated into Iran as basically chase craftsmen. But, you know, these are not underground churches. This is a massive cathedral. It is interesting when you walk in right towards the entrance, they do have the portraits of the two supreme leaders, Khomeini and Khamenei, but that's before you get into the actual church. So it's kind of a subtle message, like, you know, this is still an Islamic country, but Christians are allowed to exist there. The Armenian Christians are Armenian society, they're accepted. And when I was in Yazd, there's the Jama Mosque, which is a very large mosque. It just behind its shadow is an active synagogue. And I was told there's probably about 7 or 8 other synagogues that do exist in Yazd alone. Because I don't think their issue isn't necessarily one of religious indifference, which is a kind of a big issue that, you know, I think gets wrapped up in Middle East politics. It's that, you know, this is a Christian-Muslim thing or a Jewish-Muslim thing. More or less, 9 times out of 10, the issue is the policies of the countries that are in conflict with each other. So whether it's, you know, Israel's policy towards Iran, United States policy towards Iran, Iran's policy towards, you know, Lebanon, the geopolitics that are really determining the larger political issues. And it's, the religion is not the major issue. I think the religion gets sold to most people as a way to, you know, for the majority of the population on both sides of the issue, as a way to kind of mobilize people through fear, through indifference, and through hatred as well, that this is something that we can do. But like I said, you know, there are churches and there are synagogues, and these are not underground. They're out in the open. There are Jews and Christians in Iran.
So, Rob, there is tension right now between Israel and Iran. Israel says that Iran wants to destroy Israel. After being there for 2 weeks, did you get a sense that Iranian people hate Israel, want to see Israel destroyed, and are looking forward to launching missiles at Israel?
So, one of the more interesting things that I did every night. Like, the only real English-speaking TV channel I had access to was Press TV, which is the national Iranian state English TV channel. So it's obviously a very one-sided perspective, and they're going to tell you kind of what their perspective is, the official government perspective is. You know, I went there just after, you know, we had the tanker seized. We had, you know, drones that are getting shot down on both sides. And there was zero mention of any of that tension towards at all on Press TV. The major issue that they had coverage on as far as what the state is concerned was they developed a new missile system. And, you know, they keep telling everyone that it's for defensive purposes. You know, you can take that how you want it. But, you know, under I think it was the Bush administration banned Iran from purchasing part of the sanctions that involved them not being able to purchase kind of these anti-air defense missile systems from Russia. So over the past decade, they've effectively had to develop their own. So they now consider their missile defense system to be superior than the one that they were going to buy from the Russians. But they keep pounding away, and they're showing these live on TV, you know, demonstrating their power, obviously, and they're proud of these missiles. But they keep reiterating this is for, you know, defensive purposes. No, I didn't see any there's a couple of anti-Israeli posters, which you would see, you know, right next to an anti-American poster. But, you know, this is not a large thing that's happening. I did have an interaction with a college student who went to the University of Tehran, and I guess a few months ago they had painted, the government had painted an American flag on the entrance to the university, and which would require that when students were walking, you know, to classes that they would be stepping on the American flag. And there was actually a protest by the students. They said, you have to remove this. We're not going to go to school if you're making us step over the flag and be disrespectful like that. The anti-Israeli sentiment, it's a layer cake, and it may be a bit of an icing. I'm not going to say that it doesn't exist, but it's not on every street corner. It's not, most importantly, it's not within the hearts of the Iranian people.
Did you see lots of other foreigners in Iran? Did you happen to see Europeans or people that may have been from China? Is Iran connected to the outside world? And what was the evidence of that connection?
Yeah, so I did see a couple of Western European tourists from Germany, France, Italy. They have a little bit more freedom than they can of traveling there, obviously, than Americans, British, and Canadians. They can basically get a visa arrival for the most part in the airport. You know, obviously much different for Americans. It's a fully cash society, so there's no outside connection to the rest of the world as far as banking is concerned. So credit cards don't work there. So I basically came in with, you know, I'm carrying around large amounts of euros with me, large amounts of cash, just because there's no way for any of those credit card systems to work. That being said, on my last night in Tehran, I had about a 12-hour wait from when I got back to Tehran and from when my flight was. So I checked into this airport hotel, and the airport hotel was more or less full with Chinese tourists. And I would say one of the interesting things that I noticed is that there's basically two cars that are manufactured in Iran. One of them is a Peugeot, so it's under a French contract, but it's built and manufactured in Iran. The other one is an Iranian car that they built from the ground up. Foreign imports of everything is extremely expensive, but, you know, nobody is even really touching BMWs or Mercedes there. But some people that are more fortunate maybe have some Toyotas or something else coming out of Japan, even though that's extremely expensive. But the third, after the two top Iranian cars, I say the third most popular car, though, that you see there is actually a Chinese car. And so I think what you see is happening is that since we don't have a trading relationship with the United States, I think China is coming in there and they're more or less saying, well, you know what, if America doesn't want to do business with you, that's fine with us. You know, we're more than happy, you know, to sell you cars, to sell you products, to sell you what you need. And so they're kind of pushing in on that gap. And adding to that, when I was watching Press TV, there was a big deal that Iran was trying to move more towards using the Chinese currency as opposed to using U.S. dollar, using the euro as a fiat currency. So, you know, there is an act of maneuver by the Iranian government to align itself now more geopolitically with China, because, you know, this business is just not happening. And that's, I think, is one aspect as Americans that we need to look at and say, you know, business is going to occur. Governments are always going to take care of themselves. And if we're not in there doing business, then we're opening the door for somebody else to do business. So in a way, we're kind of hurting ourselves as far as these patients are concerned, because where we don't exist, like I said, China is more than willing to come in there. Russia is more than willing to come in there.
So what about the U.S. sanctions? The U.S. has put sanctions on Iran, and that means that other nations that want to do business with the U.S. can't, and companies that want to do business with the U.S. government can't do business there in Iran. How have the sanctions affected the people? Did you see hunger, homelessness? Did people talk to you about the U.S. sanctions?
Yeah, so, you know, currency inflation right there is currently at about 70%. So, you know, that's a pretty sizable hit that you've taken to your national income there. As far as I'll direct the homelessness issue, outside of Iran, there's not a lot of homelessness that occurs. And I kind of inquired about that. Iranian culture kind of, like throughout the Arab world, very family, even though Iran not an Arab country, is very family oriented. So families and communities tend to take care of themselves. So you don't see large amounts of homeless populations around the country, especially once you get outside of Tehran. There's also these government sanctioned charity boxes, which you see scattered everywhere. And I've seen people put money in there. So it's an official government charity. They come out there and they're helping people. That whole conversation kind of brought up an issue of drug trades and the perception of drugs in Iran. Obviously, since it sits on the border with Afghanistan, there's a high amount of heroin trafficking historically that's occurred that has gone through Iran. And heroin historically has been, if there was a drug that was destructive towards its society, it was heroin. That being said, because of, you know, the currency inflation and sanctions, you know, access to heroin is extremely expensive now. So people are now actually, they have somewhat of a problem with meth now, because meth is significantly cheaper to manufacture, you know, obviously than transporting heroin. But the sanctions have, they hurt everybody. And the thing that we need to remember, I think, that is that at the end of the day, governments always pay themselves first. So if you're a country that's under a sanction, and I witnessed this, I've been to Cuba as well, a country that's historically been under a sanction. If you're the government that's in control, you know that you have a set budget. You're going to take care of your military. You're going to take care of your ruling class. And then the people are the ones that are going to get hurt the most, because they're going to get left with what scraps are at, you know, the end of the day. So our intention of these sanctions is basically to squeeze people hard enough that they'll overthrow or they'll push for very hard reforms by themselves with their own countries. And I would argue that historically speaking, that has never really been an effective measure. It didn't happen in Cuba, hasn't ever happened in North Korea. And these are sanctions that have gone on for much, much longer. So what tends to happen at the end of the day, people will generally always choose their own government, regardless as to how corrupt that government is, over that of a foreign ruling party. So, you know, I think that's something that we need to take in mind, that the sanctions are really hurting individual Iranian citizens, you know, and they're hurting U.S. business interests. And I don't see them as really doing anything effectively towards curbing Iranian influence or influence within the nation.
So in the last few days, there's been a heightened tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and Israel's involved in this. President Trump's administration is involved in this. What's your take on the heightened tension that's going on now? Saudi Arabia blaming Iran for the attack on its oil system over the weekend, and Iran denying that it did it. But what's your take on this increased tension that's going on, with Iran being at the center of the tension?
Yeah, so that actually, the ongoing conflict in Yemen, you know, I kind of talked about this historically. There's been a lot of push and pull over the past 40 years, whether you have, Hezbollah action in Lebanon, whether you have the soft invasion of Saudi Arabia into the Kingdom of Bahrain. You know, Bahrain is a tiny island nation that's predominantly a Shiite country, but ruled by a Sunni family. And they were, you know, revolutionary type of issues that were coming up. So the Saudis invaded, they took control, and in Bahrain has more or less become the 13th province of the kingdom. So, you know, Yemen is just another kind of piece of this proxy conflict that has been ongoing for the past, you know, 30, 40 years. I will say, you know, when I was there, I did watch when I was watching on Press TV, they had the commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and he was specifically mentioning the drone strikes, the one that happened over the weekend happened in Al-Bakhaik, which is actually basically where I grew up. But, you know, this war has been ongoing with Yemen for years and years, and he made an interesting comment, though, and he says, unlike the Saudis, we are openly targeting civilians. You know, a lot of the destruction that has happened in Yemen has come off of Saudi and UAE fighter jets that have been largely supplied by the United States. And now Yemen, now it seems that there has been a significant shift, because what started off with basically Yemen, which is effectively the poorest country in the region, you had basically more or less civilians with AK-47s, and they are kind of now capable of spiking into the heart of not just Riyadh, the capital city, but of drastically hitting Saudi strategic oil facilities. I think the Saudi oil today dropped down, it's lost about a third of its value. You know, so it seems that there's been a shift. And, you know, over the past, I think it was in the past like 3 or 4 weeks, there's kind of been a divorce among the Saudi and UAE coalition towards their perception of Yemen and the direction that they're trying to take. So, once again, this is part of the larger proxy issue, but what was initially, I would say, a war of attrition, more or less, that the Saudis were pushing onto Yemen now seems to have drastically shifted in the other direction, and now Yemen seems to a certain degree have something to negotiate with, since they are capable of making these types of strikes deep within the kingdom.
Over and over again, we hear Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel criticize Iran and essentially saying that there's no hope. You know, he's certainly not trying to negotiate at all with Iran. And with people like Netanyahu in Israel saying that Iran presents an existential threat to the nation of Israel, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, there's effectively a new ruling class in Saudi Arabia with MBS, and there has been some chatter even of establishing the first Israeli embassy in Saudi Arabia, which would be a significant, this is good from a diplomatic position, you know, a peaceful, you know, recognition of one another, of, you know, the state of Israel. But this is now kind of viewed as this coalition now between Saudi Arabia and Israel is now just one more complex issue. And Iran is now, you know, kind of on the other side of that. From the Iranian perspective, when Israel makes these remarks Netanyahu makes remarks that it is an existential threat, we have to also remember that the state of Israel is also a nuclear armed country. Iran is not. So you have to kind of take everything with a grain of salt. I mean, like I said, Iran is surrounded by more or less proxies or by direct U.S. forces. And, of course, you know, you have the state of Israel, which is just possess nuclear weapons, and they are there. You know, we're not seeing any large scale, conflict directly between these two states. Like I said, everything has been more or less proxy. You know, you have Hezbollah in Lebanon, which occasionally there are offenses between Israeli forces and Lebanese forces, Hezbollah forces in Lebanon. But it's, like I said, everything you have to take with a grain of salt. And we need to remember that the state of Israel does have that weapon system. So as far as being able and capable of defending themselves against a state that doesn't have that, that does exist. So everybody just needs to take a step back and just cool down for a minute.
Well, Robert Neff, thanks for coming on WMNF. Good to talk to you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's Robert Neff, who is now a nursing student in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University. For a while, he lived in Sarasota. He actually ran for office in Sarasota as a Green Party candidate in 2016 for the Charter Review Commission. 2 weeks ago, he came back from a trip to Iran, and he was telling me what his visit to Iran was. He spent 2 weeks there. He had a minder, as he said, and He grew up living in Saudi Arabia, so he's not unfamiliar with the Middle East. So we're going to take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. I'm just going to read from the Washington Post two paragraphs. This is the latest on Iran from the Washington Post. Just a few minutes ago, they filed this story. Iran's supreme leader today ruled out direct negotiations with the United States a day after President Trump stopped short of directly blaming Iran for a major attack on Saudi Arabian oil institutions, allaying, at least for a moment, fears of military conflict between the two countries, Saudi Arabia and Iran. The comments by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei appeared to rule out a face-to-face meeting between Trump and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani at the United Nations at a meeting next week. All the officials in the Islamic Republic unanimously believe that there will be no negotiations at any level with the U.S., Khamenei said, according to remarks published on his website. That's from the Washington Post. Let's take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663, and our email address, dj@wmnf.org. There's a lot of news going on, so we can talk about this, and we can talk about some other stories, too. But let's take two phone calls right now. Let's go to Rob in Thanota Sassa, who's been waiting for a while. Hey, Rob, what would you like to say?
A very interesting guest. I was wondering whether, or I was going to ask, actually, had he stayed on, if he had ever seen this. It was an animated movie called Persepolis. And it was written by a woman who had been a young teenager during the revolution there. And it was very fascinating because, you know, prior to the revolution, Iran was very, westernized. And the kids listened to punk rock and, you know, she wore a leather jacket. And it was very secular, as he mentioned, more than people think. But what she said was that the people who were behind who supported the revolution were mostly from the working class or the uneducated class, more rural people. And that most of the middle class people there, they were sort of, they did not support it. And it flipped everything upside down in that, say, if you were a lawyer or a doctor, it would be like the next day your gardener now has power over you, you know, as part of the everything got flipped upside down. And there's a huge or very large expat community of Iranians, I understand, in Los Angeles. So there was a drain of people that fled the country. But what I was wondering is what it would take, what percentage of the people there, and he did mention it, but I didn't catch what he said, what percentage of the people there actually support the government? Because it seems so strange that if the people are very pro-American and, you know, sort of really influenced by American culture, how is that government able to remain in power, for so long? And maybe you comment on that.
Yeah, I asked him that question several different ways, and I never got to the point where I felt like I had a good answer from him. I think it's hard to say in 2 weeks, a two-week visit, what percent of the people support the government. We know that there was the Green Revolution in Iran, right, and a lot of people took the streets. They don't like what's going on. But I think he made the interesting point, that is, when Iran is attacked from the outside, people tend to gather around their government, and perhaps that's what's happening now. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, perhaps he's right about the fact that sanctions rarely produce the results that you want. But maybe, just for being, an example to the people, maybe being an inspiration to the people, that might be more effective. Because it does seem that when you start putting pressure on the country that adversely affects the population, it tends to drive people more towards a really autocratic government, rather than actually providing, inspiration for the people to rise up on their own. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that was his point, too. And the other point that he made that was interesting is that he had lived both in Saudi Arabia and now he's visited Iran. And he when you compare the two, according to him, Iran is much more liberal. A much more liberal, open society than Saudi Arabia. And yet, it seems that President Trump has a very close relationship to Saudi Arabia. And when he had Bolton on the staff, certainly a really antagonistic opinion of Iran. Hey, Rob, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Betty in Sarasota. Hi, Betty, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi, Rob. Well, nothing surprises me about Netanyahu. I think, you know, Israel is always in a state of perpetual fear and anxiety just because of who it is, where it is located, and their, you know, their history. Siding up to Saudi Arabia is a little bit distressing given their human rights, you know, record, which is pretty terrible. And I really liked your guest. The only thing is when you're a white American in these countries, and especially a male, it's a completely different perspective. I mean, the way women have been mistreated in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, I mean, for all intents and purposes, I believe that Iran is still kind of a police state. You can't do and say whatever you please. But, of course, relative to Saudi Arabia, it's much better, I would think.
Yeah, he didn't describe seeing police on every corner. So now, I'm, you know, it's a good question, but I don't think that, and we've had other people on the show talking about their visits to Iran, and nobody describes it as a police state. Now, that doesn't mean that the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, isn't in charge of everything, and I'm sure when it comes to social mores that women are certainly treated less than equal. But I, as Rob said, he lived in Saudi Arabia, and he thinks that women are treated better in Iran than they are in Saudi Arabia.
For sure.
Yeah. All right, Betty, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
To hear from you. 813-239-9663. And let's go to another Rob. This is Rob in Lutz. Hey, Rob, you're on. What would you like to say?
Oh, yeah. Good morning. Hey, thank you so much for that wonderful interview. The man is so eloquent, so educated. I lived in Holland in the 70s for 5 years in the Netherlands, and I met many, many Iranians there and learned their culture and their language and their food and fell in love with their women and their beautiful music. And I can tell you they're a very progressive, very cultured people, and I am so glad that John Bolton is gone, because he was the one fomenting all this falsehood about that beautiful, wonderful nation and its people. So maybe it shows there's a thawing of the ice and something good will come about after all.
Yeah, let's hope that we don't go to war over this. But, Rob, thanks a lot.
Yes, sir.
All right,
so
good to hear from you. And we've got an open line, 813-239-9663. Jan Roberts is our phone producer today. Thanks to Jan for coming in. Let's go to Libby, who's in Palm Harbor. Hi, Libby. What would you like to say?
I'm just hoping that everyone is keeping it right in the front of their mind that this is a self-generated crisis for our country. If we hadn't pulled out of the deal that we had that would have lasted 15 years, they wouldn't have started working on their nuclear weapons again, perhaps, as he's proud of saying. It seems like everybody's saying, well, you know, well, we started this fight. We started by breaking a promise to them. And why would they come to the table when they probably don't think we're going to keep any other promises?
Yeah, I think things were going in the right direction because Iran had agreed to halt its enrichment of uranium.
Exactly, and that just processed everything.
And every inspector who went over there, and every time the agreement was checked, Iran was complying. And now Iran itself says it's not complying with the agreement.
Well, it's because, you know, we put them in this terrible economic situation, serving their people, and we shouldn't have. We shouldn't have the sanctions reinstated. President Trump just goes around taking fights and getting it, dropping us out of the climate arrangement, dropping us out of the nuclear control thing, alienating people from NATO and all our allies. He started this. So I hope it's all laid at his feet.
So, Libby, I got to ask you, so Israel, under Prime Minister Netanyahu, has bombed locations in Iraq and in Syria and in Lebanon in the last month because those locations, and sometimes they're military installations, they're funded by Iran in those countries or they're allied with Iran in those countries. What do you think about Israel bombing nearby countries?
Well, I think Israel is somewhat paranoid, but for good reason. When a the country has said they, you know, will not recognize them as a state. You know, and the two state solution doesn't seem to be making any progress when it probably should. You know, they've said they want to push them into the sea and won't recognize Israel. But it seems like Israel encroaches so much on the Palestinian people that they are holding them hostage, much like the ghettos of Germany. I feel sorry for the Palestinians, and I wish someone could go over there and somehow bring them both to the table and figure out how to make them both equal partners, either in one state or two.
All right. And Libby, there's some news on that. Thanks a lot for your call. I'm going to read this news story from the Associated Press.
Thank you for your program.
Thank you, Libby.
Okay.
Thank you. This is news from the Associated Press this morning, and it's all about the possibility, what now appears to be the diminished possibility of a two-state solution. And the story says this: Israel's prime minister is vowing to annex settlements in the West Bank, including one deep in the heart of the largest Palestinian city, if he is reelected in today's election. Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, told Israeli Army Radio yesterday that he plans to annex all the settlements in the West Bank. When asked if that included an enclave of several hundred settlers who live in volatile Hebron, he said, of course. Netanyahu is fighting for his political survival in today's vote. He has doled out hardline promises weeks before the vote, trying to shore up far-right nationalist voters. He's also promised to annex the Jordan Valley, an area seen as the breadbasket of any Palestinian state. Critics say his pledges would eliminate any remaining Palestinian hope of establishing an independent state. So that's the latest news from Israel. And it ties in to the tension in that part of the world. Patrick writes this regarding Iran. He says, a couple of months back, I watched a series of videos from a New Zealand travel vlog, and it was interesting to see he did not have a minder during his time in Iran. Many of the people in the videos assumed he was American and treated him as a rock star, as your guest mentioned, writes Pat in Sarasota. Pat, thank you for that. And we've got a few minutes left. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. So if you want to comment about anything you've heard here, you can call us up and talk about it. There's lots of other news, including the GM strike. It doesn't appear to be fixed. Cokie Roberts from NPR has died. One of the mainstays of NPR news, especially when I started listening to NPR in the 70s, Cokie was there, died of breast cancer today at the age of 75. But our phone number, 813-239-9663, email address is dj@wmnf.org. And if you've got something that you want to mention, you can bring it up. And Jan Roberts is our phone producer today. And let's see if we can get one more phone call in before the end of the show. And I think somebody's calling in right now. Maybe, maybe not. Let's go to Saeed in Tampa. Hold on. We'll get Saeed in just a moment. Maybe. Maybe not. All right, there's Saeed right now. Saeed, you're on. What would you like to say? Hi, Saeed. You're on the air.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I should tell you, Iranian people love American people. Iranian people are in line with American people.
And Saeed, how do you know this? Let me ask you, are you from Iran?
I am from Iran.
Okay, and so tell me a little bit more. What was your reaction to what our guest Rob Neff had to say?
What is obvious, the Iranian government has been terrorizing their own citizens, their own neighbors. They are involved in all terrorist activity and supporting all groups that one way or another been supported by them.
Okay, and Rob, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. But thank you very much for your phone call. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Your hero, Mark Bureau, is coming up next. This is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Hey, tonight, if you haven't seen it, tune in and watch the Ken Burns documentary about country music. Tonight, Hank Williams will be on. Here's the Grateful Dead doing a Hank Williams song right here on WMNF in Tampa.